You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, this is Robin Johnson, and welcome back to another edition of The Best of Heartland Politics, a radio show I began in 2014 that I'm proud to say is now a regular podcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. You know, it's not often you get to interview one of the top musicians and performers from throughout your life. But I got that chance when Bill Medley, one of the famous Righteous Brothers, agreed to come on my show and talk about his biography called, aptly enough, The Time of My Life. This interview wasn't just about his music, but about his life and the times he lived in, and the impact of his music and the Righteous Brothers on our American culture. For example, he'll share the story of how he and Bobby Hatfield were mistaken for being African American by a radio station that heard their music before actually meeting them, and how their music made rhythm and blues more palatable for white audiences in the 1960s. You'll hear the tragedy in his family and how he persevered. You'll hear about the impact of their music on our troops in Vietnam. And on a lighter note, you'll hear about his preferred post-show meal, which told me a lot about him and his common guy persona. Bill's just a really good guy and really friendly person to talk to. He's still performing, and his career featured many ups and downs and comebacks. It's truly an American story. Here's my interview with Bill Medley, one of the famous Righteous Brothers, on The Best of Heartland Politics. Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to Heartland Politics. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today we have a real treat for our listeners. We're taking a break from insider politics and all that to talk with an American music legend, a man who was part of one of the most recognizable duos in music history, who also made it on his own and is an inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with hit records in four different decades. He's the author of an autobiography called The Time of My Life, and he'll be in Iowa soon. We'll talk about that in just a second. But my guest today is Bill Medley from the Righteous Brothers. Bill, thanks so much for taking the time to be on our show today.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You know, I really enjoyed this book, and I highly recommend it to folks who love music but just like reading stories about people and how they overcame challenges. I want to start off just by letting you talk about, I thought the first really interesting story of the book was when you first met your longtime partner, Bobby Hatfield, and discovered you had similar musical tastes, which led to how the Righteous Brothers got their name.
Yeah, I mean, back in 1962, Bobby and I were raised in Orange County, California, and Bobby had a group, a little rock and roll group, called the Variations. I had a group called the Paramours, and we had a mutual friend of ours that was working Vegas a lot, that he wanted to kind of leave Vegas and come back home and spend more time with his family. So he wanted to put a group together that he thought would get a lot of work. So he took Bobby and Bobby's drummer and myself and my guitar player and put us all together, and we were the Paramours. And I knew Bobby a little bit. I mean, I obviously had heard about him, and he heard about me, and it was unusual to have rock and roll bands back there in 62 anyway, but we were put together, and we were the Paramours, and Bobby was raised on, we were both raised on listening to the same black radio station out of L.A., because Orange County is about 40 miles out of L.A. And so we were both raised on rhythm and blues. And so when we were put together, and at night in the clubs, we would do all these rhythm and blues black great duets. And we just had a ball singing together. He was so good. And it was so much fun. And Orange County in those days was very, very white county. But there was a Marine base there called El Faro Marine Base. And there was the black Marines there heard that there was these two white guys at the club singing rhythm and blues. So a lot of the black guys started coming in to see us. And there they had a saying, like, if you had a really neat car, great-looking car, they might would say, boy, what a righteous-looking car, which meant good, what a good-looking car. And if they liked you as a friend, they'd call you a brother. So a lot of times when we were coming to work or whatever, they would say, hey, righteous brother, how you doing? Which meant good friend. And I had written a song called Little Lap Loopy Lou way back there in 62, 63. And a record company wanted to record it. We recorded it, and we needed a name because it was just Bobby and I. It wasn't the whole group. And I think it was Bobby that said, let's call ourselves what the Marines have been calling us, the Righteous Brothers. And we did. I mean, we didn't think it was going to, you know, the record was going to do anything. But, boy, it did enough to get the ball rolling, and I'm still here.
People don't realize, but Rhythm and Blues, as was pointed out in the book, wasn't done yet by white guys. I mean, you were two white guys, the book says, who sounded black. And I like that story about when you were promoting Little Latin Loopy Lou, kind of something that Atlantic forgot to mention.
Yeah. Well, you know, Atlantic Records was distributing the records, so we went Atlantic Records was an all black, you know, label, real rhythm and blues label. And there was a lot of black stations already playing Little Loopy Lou. And when we went on a, you know, promotion tour to promote Little Latin Loopy Lou, and they would take us into the black radio stations. And when we were introduced to them as the Righteous Brothers, they couldn't believe we were white. So I think we did more harm than we did good, because I think a lot of the stations quit playing the record. And it wasn't a racial thing. It was like, listen, we play country music. We don't play rhythm and blues. You know, it was a black station. And I mean, and listen, in 63, 64, when Bobby and I started and we're doing, now it probably seems like, wow, what a great commercial thing to do. It was the most uncommercial thing you could do for two white guys to try and sound black. We weren't trying to sound black. That was just the way we sang. And because the white stations wouldn't play Loopy Lou because they thought we were black, and the black stations stopped playing it because they knew we were white. So it was like, damned if you do and damned if you don't, you know?
Well, I thought the quote in the book that talked about, of course, this was called Blue Eyed Soul, but you R&B more palatable for white America. So you played a role, an important role, a gateway for that type of music, which is now embedded in our culture of among all races and ethnicities.
Yeah, we, you know, certainly weren't trying to open any doors, and Bobby and I, all we knew that we certainly weren't the only white guys that were singing rhythm and blues and sounding black. There was a whole bunch of great, great blue-eyed singers, but we opened the door, and then they, you know, they just flooded on through. And the quote of a blue-eyed soul, I think it was a disc jockey in Philadelphia, you know, they finally just, I guess, not even before Love and Feeling, I don't know what records it was, but the black radio station was playing our music, and the disc jockey would always say, here's my blue-eyed soul brothers, and you'd play our record. Well, blue-eyed soul, he was really just telling his audience that these guys are white, because, you know, a black guy would refer to a white guy in, you know, in the 40s and 50s as a blue-eyed. You know, he's blue-eyed, which meant he was white. And then somehow, some way, blue-eyed soul caught on, and we're to blame.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you did. Yeah, that's blame you'd want to take ownership of. You talk about the 60s and when two generations of music were at war. It was a fascinating period. I was a kid growing up then. The British invasion, you had hippies, psychedelics, it's talked about. And here you come up with Love and Feeling hits number one and changes your life. How did that come about?
Well, we were signed to Moonglow Records and being distributed by Atlantic, but we were signed to Moonglow Records, and Phil Spector had who was a great producer, and called Moonglow and said, I want to produce the Righteous Brothers, and I want to buy or lease the remainder of their contract. We had about two more years on our contract, and we said, okay, we thought it would be fun to work with Phil. We liked his records, and even though he was doing mainly girls and this and that, but we thought he probably would do a good job. And so he called Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, two great, great songwriters, and said, I'm going to be producing the Righteous Brothers, and I want you to write a song for them. And they wrote You've Lost That Love and Feeling. And, boy, and it absolutely is a record that should not have been hit, but now it's the most played record in the history of American radio.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 64 and 65, when it was released, it was way too long. It was over 4 minutes. And in the 60s, you made records that were about 2 minutes and 30 seconds, you know, 2.5 minutes. So this was, and it sounded like it was on the wrong speed. And everything that was wrong about it, I think, kind of became a plus when they started playing it. It was a pretty, pretty hard hitting, dramatic love song for, you know, kids to grab a hold on, I think was, because before that, I think, Frankie Avalon and those kind of songs were pretty light songs, you know, and this was a pretty heavy hitting love song.
And you followed that up in 66 with Soul and Inspiration, which actually was on Billboard, on top Billboard charts longer than Love and Feeling was.
And that's an interesting story, is that Soul and Inspiration was supposed to be our follow-up record to Love and Feeling, and we were working in New York with Barry and Cynthia, who were writing it, and Barry and Cynthia got in an argument with Phil Spector, and all of a sudden we were back in California working with a young little girl called Carol Kane on a new song. And so when we left Phil, I called Barry Mann, and I said, where's that song? I think it was Soul and Inspiration. Please send it to me. You know, I'm going to produce the Righteous Brothers. And so get me that song. He said, heck, I didn't even finish that song. I said, well, finish it and send it to me. And so he sent it to me, and I produced it. Actually, all I did is what I thought Phil Spector would have done with it. And, it was on the chart longer than Love and Feeling.
I thought it was really interesting, your reaction in the book, when you heard our troops coming back from Vietnam saying they listened to music, and it was an inspiration to them.
Yeah, that's probably the greatest compliment we could get, you know, is that, these Vietnam vets coming up and saying, I just want to know how important your music was to us over there in Vietnam and how touched they were and this and that. And Bobby and I always used to say, man, if that's all our music did, that was plenty. So, you just don't know how your music is touching people. And the cool thing in the last few years, we go out and sign autographs and, you know, sell some merchandise after the show. And we get to meet a lot of the people and hear all their wonderful stories of how the music, you know, touched them. And it's just, it's amazing. And it's still amazing to me that, you know, how music can touch people. I should know. I mean, I was touched when I was a kid by music, you know, the same way people that were touched were listening to ours. So I did it. But boy, the veterans, that was amazing.
The interesting part of this book, too, as we go through it, was the impact of other media, cultural media, on mediums on your career. TV was one, but the movies. And three movies, bing, you know, right in a row, that really opened your music to new generation of fans.
Yeah. I mean, if you wrote the Wright Brothers story and made a movie out of it, you'd say, nah, that couldn't happen. I mean, I don't know, in about 87 or whatever it was, they put Love and Feeling in Top Gun. Then the next year, I had a hit with I Had the Time of My Life with Dirty Dancing. Then the next year, they put Unchained Melody in Ghost. And literally, we were back hotter than ever. And here we are at night. In 1990, looking at each other and saying, well, I guess we better go do this.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on KBUR AM 1490 and FM 99.3 here in Burlington, Iowa. This is host Robin Johnson, and this is a real treat for me today to be able to interview one of the greats of American music history, Bill Medley, the Righteous Brothers. He's going to be in Cedar Rapids, folks, on the night of August 25th. That's my birthday. 7:30 at the Paramount Theater. And great chance for our listeners here in Eastern Iowa, Western Illinois to go hear Bill and your partner Bucky Hurd, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So it should be a great opportunity, and I'm sure it's to hear American music legend. This isn't, you know, normally my viewers tune in and listen to deep talks about politics and stuff. This isn't that, but this is talking about the role of music in American life and our culture. And, of course, culture is politics. So there is some background here at some degree on politics through our American culture and in music. One thing I wasn't aware of was that you got into country music, and after seeing where you, you know, your roots, I guess it wasn't that much of a surprise.
Yeah, I always loved country music, and because you know, like I said, I was raised on rhythm and blues and country music, at least, you know, older country music. You know, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, George Jones. Pretty much, you know, if it was the right song, it was pretty much like doing a blues song, but lyrically, they had more of a story to it. So I was really drawn to it. And my dad was a Texan and raised on a ranch. And so I was a little country and a little rock and roll. I loved it. And I toured with Alabama, Group Alabama in, 85 and, you know, did pretty well in country. Then I just finally ended coming back to my roots and I, you know, just very comfortable singing, you know, kind of rhythm and blues. And even though I don't think Love and Feeling and that stuff is very rhythm and blues, but I'll take it.
You know, as somebody who I teach part time at a local college, and I was touched by the story in the early 70s. You had developed some throat problems, and you went back to your high school choir teacher, and you give credit. You're very generous with credit to others for your career, which I think is admirable. But you might share that story a little bit about your high school teacher.
Yeah. I was one of those real jerks in high school. You know, I quit high school when I was 16, but thank God I got to 1 year in high school anyway. And my choir teacher, Jack Coleman, was just an incredible, incredible Christian and wonderful guy. And he really kind of tried, he paid a lot of attention to me. He tried to keep my interest up, you know, because he knew I was, you know, I was getting five F's and one A in school. The A was in choir. And he was amazing. And somewhere in about, probably 73, 74, I was working in Vegas on my own, not the Righteous Brothers, but on my own as Bill Medley. And I got laryngitis. I had to keep singing, and I was doing three shows a night, and I just wrecked my voice. And I was told by two of the biggest doctors in Hollywood that I would never sing again, ever. And I happened to run in Jack Coleman about, I went out on the pier and probably had a few beers in me, but I went out on the pier and I'm yelling at God. I mean, I am just yelling at God and really angry that, you know, I'm saying, why did you give me this voice and then just take it away? I'm crying. And it was really, I mean, because that's all I do is sing. I'm just a singer. And I ran into Jack Coleman about 2 weeks after that. And he said, how you doing? I said, I'm not doing well at all. And at this point, Jack was giving voice lessons. And I told him what the problem was, and then he said, I'll never sing again. And Jack looked at me as sure as anything, and he said, I can get that voice back for you. I can help you. I said, no, Jack, it's very sweet, but you know, no, it won't happen. So he talked me into giving me some voice lessons, and I was taking two lessons every day for five days a week. And he's just the only man in the world I would have let push me around like he did. I mean, he didn't push me around, but, you know, very, very determined. And I never paid my bills. I always had a business manager that would pay my bills. And I realized that I hadn't been paying Jack for the lessons. And I after the one lesson, I said, Jack, I need all your information so I can give it to my bookkeeper so she can, you know, pay you and pay, you know, and get paid up. And he said, no. He says, I'm not, he said, I don't want any money. I said, no, come on, man. I said, you know, I don't have a voice, but I got some money. he said, no. He said, I can't take any money. I said, why? He said, because about a week before I ran into you, God told me to heal your voice. And, boy, that just took me to my knees. And, finally, I got a chance to pay him back. He was taking a choir to Europe, and I got a chance to, you know, give some money to that. And so, you know, I'm obviously a spiritual guy, and that was just remarkable, remarkable to me.
I think most people, successful people, have had influential people and teachers in their backgrounds. I know I have that really make you into the person you are. And that's an inspirational story there. I really, a couple quotes here that as we kind of move towards the end of this, I thought this was interesting. You talked about how people often hear with their eyes, and you also said that you never consider yourself a singer as much a storyteller. Share with our listeners kind of what you know, deeper in that, what that means for you and for them.
Well, I've always said, you know, with people that want to write a song for me or this and that, I said, you need to put it in my speaking voice. You know, I need to almost speak the words instead of singing them. I mean, I can sing, but I'm not what I would consider a great singer. I am I just have right, wrong, or indifferent a way of, saying those songs, you know. And so I just think, and for some reason, at least on stage and records too, that, you know, people really kind of just get that, you know. It's a lot more emotional. When the song is right in my speaking voice, it's "You never close your eyes." Well, that's kind of me speaking all that, and that's how I do it. Everybody has their way of doing it, but it's real important to me what the lyrics are saying, and that I believe what the lyrics are saying, and so that's just my style. Everybody has their own.
You had a comment in there that pain and loneliness invades the music. I thought the word "invade" was purposely used, but really strong.
Yeah, well, it does. I mean, you know, you start singing and you start singing something that's pretty emotional or soulful and lyrically. And before you know it, that pain, wherever that pain is coming from, just kind of invades the song. I mean, I don't call for it to. And sometimes it doesn't happen, you know. Sometimes you got a headache on stage or a bad leg or whatever. But, we all... You know, they talk a lot about soul, you know, or you're soulful or this and that. Well, soul is just emotion, and we all have it, and because we've all lived through good things, great things, terrible things, and I'm pretty in touch with. With my the stuff that went wrong or this and that and the downside and when the pain, you know, invades the song, it's not like I walk off stage and still have the pain, but it'll jump up and bite itself into that song, you know. Thank God.
Well, before I have a final question, actually, have you related another story, which I thought was one of the best in the book? The book is called The Time of My Life, A Righteous Brother's Memoir. I highly recommend this book. Bill wrote it along with Mike Marino, who is involved in the anecdote I'm about to share and have Bill talk about. But here's some of the people that you've ran into that are in this book, and I don't want to give them all away because Frank Sinatra, Count Basie, Elvis, Kenny Rogers, Waylon Jennings, the Rolling Stones, Sylvester Stallone, Glenn Campbell, Johnny Carson, and the Beatles. We're probably not going to get time, but you actually, the Righteous Brothers opened were with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones in the 60s, which is an interesting story on its own. But the story I want to kind of close with, because we're running over on our time a little bit here, is what I call the food writer story. And I shared this with your manager, Tim, and he got a chuckle out of it. But I thought this was telling on who you are as a person. And I just want you to maybe relate this as Mike did in the close of the book.
I'm sorry.
This was the story where he tells about how most celebrity guests, food writers, the food they have after the shows are extensive. What's yours?
Yeah. Well, I hate to give away my soulful secrets, but my road manager came to me years ago, I think when we were in the 90s and doing a lot of work, said, you know, we need a writer. What do you want to eat after the show or drink or this? And I said, I don't need anything. I just need some water, this and that. And they pushed it and they pushed it and they pushed it and said, no, come on, man, we need something. I said, okay, I want a bologna sandwich with raw onions, tomato, and yellow mustard, and that's it. And that's what I get.
I love it. There you go. That he talked about in part of the book where that he says, quote, that tells you all you need to know about him. And class without pretension. And I think those are good qualities to have. And certainly it's a salute to you. And I want to thank you again for taking the time to be our guest today. Let me remind our guest, Bill and Bucky Hurd, the Righteous Brothers, will be in Cedar Rapids. That's just an hour and a half from here, folks. August 25th, 7:30 at the Paramount Theater. This is your chance to go hear a living music legend in our great country. And again, the book is excellent, and I'm looking forward to hearing you again. And so, Bill, thank you very much for taking the time to.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.